19. Clocking into the nostalgia industry. ABC wasted little time in putting together a new version of Gary's 1950s show. American Graffiti took off in the summer of 1973. The network was determined to get its 50s program on the air no later than January 1974. This fast-track process forced me to do some fast-track thinking. Should I compromise my education at USC by joining a series again? Could I reduce my course load and do college and TV at the same time? Would signing a 7-year contract, the wildly optimistic but standard length of a commitment that an actor made when he joined a new show, postpone or even unravel my dreams of directing? I decided to go for it. Happy Days, which is what ABC was calling the new show, had much to recommend it. The pay was good, $3,500 per episode. The program was being built around my character, Richie Cunningham. Isn't that all anyone in my business could ask for? Yes, I told my agent, Bill Schuler. I'm in. Then Bill dropped a bomb. I wasn't a shoe-in. They wanted me to screen test for the Richie role. This exasperated me. I hadn't even tested for the original pilot. I mean, come on. I was one of the damn stars of the movie they were trying to emulate. What does a guy have to do? My competitive juices flowing, I agreed to the test. I was once again paired with Anson Williams, who reprised his role as Potsy. We were given a 4-page scene to read, with Gary Marshall directing. The footage would be screened for various suits at ABC and Paramount Television. Gary later told me that he allotted Anson and me a generous 3 hours to work out our scene, as opposed to 1 hour apiece for the other paired actors, to tip the scales in our favor. He wanted us all along. The only other serious candidate for the Richie role was a handsome, talented newcomer named Robbie Benson, who, like me, was a budding multi-hyphenate. A few years later, he starred in a terrific movie that he wrote with his father, One-on-One. Anson and I thankfully recaptured our roles. A few weeks later, I drove my VW Bug to the Paramount lot, where I gave my name to the guard in the gatehouse, and he told me that I was on the list, with a reserved parking space awaiting. To this day, hearing this always gives me a rush of satisfaction. After I found my spot, we did the first read-through of the first Happy Days episode. I reconnected with Marion Ross and shook hands with Tom Bosley, our new Howard Cunningham. I instantly had a good feeling about Donnie Most, a jovial fellow redhead who was playing the new character, Ralph Mouth, one of Richie's and Potsy's friends. I was really curious about who would be playing Fonzie, another new character who had 6 lines in the first episode. He was a likable tough guy, modeled after Paul Lamatt's character in Graffiti, John Milner, and Danny Zuko in Grease, as well as the Hamish hoodlums who Gary knew growing up in the Bronx. Fonzie's real name was Arthur Fonzarelli, like Gary himself, whose father changed the family name from Masciarelli to Marshall. He was Italian-American. This fact notwithstanding, I expected Fonzie to look like Steve McQueen, rugged yet pretty, a glamour biker. But no one in the room fit that physical description. Then one of Happy Days' executive producers, Tom Miller, took me aside and said that he wanted to introduce me to an amazing actor who had blown everyone away at the auditions. He was not what I expected. More of an Al Pacino, Dustin Hoffman type, on the small side, 5'6", with floppy, center-parted dark hair and a scruffy beard. He was a worldly, educated native New Yorker who had earned an undergraduate degree at Emerson College in Boston and a Master of Fine Arts at the Yale School of Drama. He offered his hand and smiled. "Ron, it's so nice to meet you," said this man who was almost 28 and seemed so much more gracious and grown up than me. "I'm Henry Winkler." I shook Henry's hand, and so began a relationship that in unexpected and sometimes complicated ways, would transform my career and indeed my life.
We were happy to see Ron stay in the acting business. Work is work, and a series could be a lucrative job. Directing could wait for a while. We were happy to see Ron, period. Though I seized the opportunity to claim his old bedroom, the best one in the house, I missed having my brother around every day. He checked in fairly often. Our place was close to Cheryl's, and he sometimes met with Dad to work on scripts. The year that Ron got Happy Days, he came by to hang out when Dad was away on a location shoot, leaving Mom and me by ourselves. Dad was in North Carolina, working on a movie called Where the Lilies Bloom. It was a great gig, one of the best of Dad's career. The film's producer, Robert Radnitz, was riding high on the critical and commercial success of his previous film, the Oscar-nominated Sounder, and this was his follow-up. Like Sounder, Where the Lilies Bloom was a family-friendly movie about poor folk in the South. In this case, a widower and his four kids who worked as sharecroppers in the Great Smoky Mountains. Dad played the widower, Roy Luther, a sickly man who instructs his children to bury him in an unmarked grave when he dies. By concealing his death, the kids will not be made wards of the state and split up. Roy meets his maker relatively early in the film, but for Dad, who was accustomed to being Mr. Two Lines, this was a substantial role, a lot to sink his teeth into. And it was a substantial film, well received upon its release in 1974. Ron and I were contentedly lounging around in our house when we heard unusual noises coming from Mom, who was downstairs in the kitchen. She was on the phone with Dad, and she was yelling. This was not normal. Our folks had occasional spats, but these never upset us much because every married couple does. One thing Mom and Dad definitely did not do was yell at each other. So this attracted my and Ron's attention. The way our house was laid out, we could station ourselves at the top of the stairs in such a way that Mom didn't see us. The call went on for a distressingly long time. Mom would get agitated, calm a bit, and then build steam back up to a point where she was even more wound up than before. It was like a little earthquake that progressed into the big one. Ron and I silently cast glances at each other, trying to get the picture of what was going on. It was like listening to a ball game on the radio, only there was nothing remotely entertaining about it.
Little by little, the contours of the argument became clear. Dad was nearing the end of his trip, but he had told Mom that he needed to stay a little longer than expected. Mom had received this news poorly. She kept saying the name Vera, as in, "You're with Vera. I know you are." Vera, as in Vera Miles, who had played Clint's mom in the movie Gentle Giant and was the mother to both of us in The Wild Country. I was confused and rattled. Mom hung up on Dad at one point, only to pick up the phone when it rang again to resume their arguing. When she hung up for the last time, Mom was in tears. We wandered down to the kitchen. I said, "What's wrong, Mom?" She exploded. "He's in North Carolina, and Vera is there, and she's got her eye on Rance, and I'm not going to stand for it." It was true that Vera Miles was in North Carolina on location with the Where the Lilies Bloom crew. She had recently divorced her husband and was newly partnered with Dad's friend, Bob Jones, who was serving as the movie's assistant director, the same Bob Jones who lent me his two horses for my film, Old Paint. The Lilies shoot had run over schedule, and the production had chosen to extend Dad for an extra week. To Mom, this had shades of, "Don't wait up for me, honey. I'll be working late." But it just didn't make sense. Films run over schedule all the time. Mom and Vera had been such fast friends on the set of The Wild Country. Then came an unburdening that knocked me sideways. "I was happy in Duncan," Mom said, referring to her Oklahoma hometown. "I've put in all these years. I've been taken for granted. Well, I'm not putting up with that. I've had it. I'm just going to pack my things and go home." The sting of her words was compounded by how uncharacteristic they were. Mom's default behavioral mode was chipper, chatty optimism. I recognized that there were things that upset her, like those times in public when people approached her and Dad and thoughtlessly asked, "Is that your son?" I was old enough to understand that no marriage is perfect and that every partnership that endures must weather some adversity. But I was unprepared for something like this. The force of it was so great and unexpected that my mind went into instant worst-case scenario mode, projecting forward. This is what it looks like when a family begins to fall apart. This is what happens to show business families. Now it's happening to us. Things will never be the same. Having witnessed my share of kids and family units damaged by the stresses of our business, I had nevertheless assumed that the Howards were immune. We had made it this far. We had always lived in a bubble of safety, love, and mutual trust, or so I had believed. My next thought was to protect Clint. I was already on the cusp of adulthood, out of the house, but at 14, he still had a ways to go. He wasn't finished growing up. Now, what was going to happen to him? I grabbed Clint and said, "Let's get out of here." We drove to Cheryl's house. I reported to her what had happened. Cheryl was a child of divorce and talked a little about her parents' breakup. We were both sensitive to Clint, not wanting to alarm him. But what to do in the meantime? I decided to drive the three of us to Glendale, the next town over where they had batting cages. For a quarter, you could buy 12 swings at pitches shot out by machines at various speed levels. For $3.50, you could buy a half hour's worth of unlimited swings. I went for the deluxe package, figuring that it would burn off a lot of the anxiety and stress that Clint and I were feeling.
Given that I was 14, I had not fully developed the emotional capacity to process what was going on. My gut instinct was to giggle, not at Mom, but at the whole scene, in a, "isn't this all kind of nutty" way. I saw how upset Mom was, and I was thrown by the venom coming out of her mouth. But I also thought it would all pass. Ron was more affected because he was so deeply in love with Cheryl and better understood the stakes, the gravity. Don't get me wrong. I was freaked out when Mom declared she was moving back to Duncan. We were so settled in the greater Burbank area that I couldn't imagine us ever living anywhere else. The thought flashed through my mind that if Mom really did move back to Oklahoma, I, at least, would stay in California with Dad. But as bad as that day was, I just couldn't see a horrible development like that happening. I thought that Mom and Dad would be okay.
The moving back to Duncan thing really disturbed me. Yes, I was almost out of my teens, but in the moment, I worried about the heartbreak and destabilization this could bring to our nuclear family. My concerns for Clint were really concerns for both of us. It threw me that Mom referred to Duncan, a place I'd only been to a few times, as home. Wasn't her home with us, her kids, in the San Fernando Valley? Wasn't that what we were all about? When we got to the batting cages, I calmed down a little, if only because Cheryl had offered some soothing words, and taking swings with Clint was a nice distraction. But then I noticed that we had been recognized, and we were attracting a few young onlookers, some of whom were using the O word. "Look, Opie and Mark are having batting practice," some kid said. "Hey, Opie, where's Barney Fife? Hey, Mark, where's your bear?" Even when Clint made solid contact and drove the ball, the compliments were framed as needling remarks. "Mark's a better hitter than Opie." We had always been taught to be gracious in public, so we didn't engage with these kids. But I came close this time. Clint and I were trying to get through something heavy, and these assholes wouldn't just let us be. To top it off, they approached us when we were done hitting to ask us for autographs, thrusting some wrinkled napkins in our faces to sign. We obliged because, well, that's what our folks would have expected us to do. But in my mind, in that moment, I was cursing the very fact of public life. We returned home with some apprehension. Mom had not entirely regained her composure, but she was palpably de-escalating. She hadn't taken a return to Duncan off the table. She said, but I haven't called to get a flight yet. Maybe I will tomorrow. She was talking herself off the ledge. Mom shut down my attempts to have a conversation about what went down, though. She needed to work through her feelings by herself.
Dad flew home a few days later, after his filming was complete, and they were fine, as loving as ever. Ron and I both asked him what had happened. He said that he really didn't know. He assured us that there was nothing going on between him and Vera Miles. "There's no reason for your mother to be afraid," he said. "Vera is with Bob Jones. That's what she was doing in North Carolina. I don't know what got her so upset." Being an immature wise-ass, I made some ill-considered crack about menopause. Dad gently but firmly shut me down. He wasn't the type to sweep things under the rug and pretend that their fight had never happened. But he made it clear to me, in no uncertain terms, that Mom's pain was nothing to joke about. Her fuse had been lit, and Dad's needing to stay on location longer than anticipated was the thing that made her combust. Now that I'm older and a little wiser, I think that the fight was really about love. Mom and Dad had sparks flying between them from the moment they met. I don't mean that they had a tempestuous relationship, because they didn't, but it was a passionate one. When you love someone that much and don't feel like you're receiving reciprocal love, you're capable of being more deeply hurt by that person than by anyone else.
This marked the only time that we ever saw Mom truly crack under the pressures that life placed upon her. For 2 decades, hers was the voice of optimism and good cheer in our family, and her sense of self was linked to her husband's and children's careers. I suspect that she felt emotionally vulnerable in 73 because, as a family, we were in a period of transition. Clint and I were growing up and becoming less reliant upon her. The empty nest loomed. Dad wanted to reclaim his life as an actor rather than as his kid's manager and mentor. Remember, one of the reasons Mom gave up acting is that she didn't want to be apart from Dad for extended periods. So Dad's long location shoot came at a bad time in that regard. I also suspect that Dad must not have handled what she was saying with his usual patience and grace. It takes 2 for a blow-up like that to happen. In fairness to Mom, we only heard her side of the telephone conversation. Whatever Dad was saying on his side, he was not soothing her. I don't think Mom meant all those comments she made about regretting her life choices. It was heat-of-the-moment stuff. Not unlike when young parents, at their most exasperated, question why the hell they had kids in the first place. The talk that Mom and I had 15 years later in her hospital room before her open-heart surgery, where she revealed her conversations with the Cocoon actresses and spoke of her idyllic Duncan childhood, was like a bookend to this episode. She chose positivity over negativity. In her final year, as her body was failing her, she demonstrated this philosophy by asking Dad to help her revisit the places they had cherished in their younger years. Sequoia National Park in Northern California, with its mighty trees, the Grand Canyon, and her beloved New York City. In a twist out of Dickens, just as she and Dad pulled up in a yellow cab to look at the old apartment building on Riverside Drive where they had shacked up as young lovers, a wrecking ball swung through the building's brick facade. They hung around to observe the demolition of their love nest. I asked Mom if she found the scene upsetting. "No, just lucky," she said. "We got there just in time. It's like they waited for us." I thought a lot about my own life's arc when I got Happy Days. I was pleased to have landed the role that I considered to be rightfully mine in the first place, but I was ambivalent. I questioned whether my pragmatism was getting in the way of my passion. I was replaying scenes from my childhood of Dad sitting by the phone and of him and his character actor buddies hanging out on weekdays as they struggled to find work. I thought to myself, who are you to turn down the lead in a network sitcom? I was also heartened by the unsatisfying experience of having done The Smith Family. My first time out on a series, I was on a hit that ran for 8 seasons. My second time out, I was on a dud. Now I was at the point where I believed that the good fortune that I'd experienced on The Andy Griffith Show was a once-in-a-lifetime blessing. Happy Days might go for a season or two, and that would be that. When it died its inevitable death, I would collect my last paycheck, go back to film school full-time, and resume my quest to become a director. This calculus changed in my very first read-through with Henry Winkler. Instant chemistry. Fonzie was only a supporting player in our first official Happy Days episode, which centered around a date that Potsy had set up for Richie with Mary Lou Milligan, a girl reputed to be fast. Anson and I had by far the most dialogue, but there was a scene near the end in which I had to screw up the courage to tell the Fonz that I had lied to him. I had not gone all the way with Mary Lou. "I'm gonna forget it this time," Henry as Fonzie said. "But no more lying. I'll do all the lying." Henry's conservatory training was evident from the start. Happy Days was far from fully formed in that first season. At the beginning, it was flagrantly lifting ideas from American Graffiti, with vintage cars everywhere and a prominent soundtrack of oldies, like Bobby Darin's Splish Splash and Elvis's Hound Dog. But Fonzie arrived fully formed. He already did the thumbs-up gesture. He already had that magical, wordless bit where he pulled his comb from his back pocket, checked himself out in the bathroom mirror, and acknowledged with a confident shrug that he looked perfect as he was. Off-camera, Henry had a menschy, almost professorial manner of speaking, but as Fonzie, his speech assumed a jabbing, edgy cadence. "Don't knock it till you've tried it, Cunningham." Above all, he knew how to find laughs that weren't on the page, that came through pauses, gestures, and improvisation. Henry later told me that part of this approach came from being dyslexic. He had trouble reading from a script, but if he absorbed its gist in advance, he could come up with a performance that worked. Henry crackled with the same energy, intellect, and creative inventiveness as Rick Dreyfuss. They reminded me of each other in a lot of ways. Short Jewish guys, a few years my senior, who were generous of spirit and had a lot to teach me. And they were both so inherently funny. I was surrounded by comedy savants. Tom Bosley, who was a Tony-winning musical comedy star on Broadway. Marion Ross, who had done sitcoms since the 1950s. Anson, with whom I had already developed a buddy comedy rapport, and Donnie, a Brooklyn guy with vaudevillian timing. You know who I didn't find particularly funny? Me. I brought this up with Gary Marshall right before we began shooting, as we were doing camera tests. Gary was a relentlessly upbeat man with a wide smile of chiclet teeth and a sweet Jewish mother-like way of talking, even though his background was Bronx Italian. He specialized in two things, getting laughs and putting people at ease. I approached him in all earnestness and declared, "Gary, I've been thinking about this and I want you to know I'm really not very funny." Like the truly funny person he was, Gary hit me with an instant comeback. "Now you tell me?" he said. Then he gently talked me off the ledge. He explained that my role was to be like Andy in The Andy Griffith Show, the leading man as straight man, behaving sensibly when everyone around him is kinda nuts. He had an even better metaphor for what I was doing from a comedic standpoint. "You're the Bob Cousy," he said. Cousy was the Boston Celtics point guard at the beginning of their dynasty years, the Houdini of the hardwood. His great gift was for dishing out assists to the talented players around him, guys like Bill Russell and Tommy Heinsohn. But Cousy was also adept at taking the shot himself when the situation called for it. I loved this metaphor. Later on, when we started filming Happy Days before a live studio audience, Gary sometimes warmed up the crowd before the show by doing introductions, and mine was, "Here he is, folks, Ron Howard, the Bob Cousy of comedy." Gary was a good Red Auerbach to my coos. He instilled in me a sense of pride in what I was accomplishing. I hadn't completely banished my belief that I should really be honing my chops as a director, but in the moment, I had to acknowledge how awesome it was. One of the big three networks had made me the lead of a primetime show. The Andy, not the Opie. Happy Days made its debut as a mid-season replacement program on January 15, 1974. Our time slot was Tuesday at 8 p.m. We found a dedicated audience right away, finishing our half season ranked number 16 in the Nielsen ratings, good enough to guarantee us renewal for the 1974-75 season. The demographic breakdown of the show's viewership was telling. In the 18 to 49 category, we ranked even higher, seventh place, attracting young viewers and their parents. We were second overall in our time slot because we were up against Maude, Norman Lear's audacious, very adult-themed sitcom starring Bea Arthur, which had spent 2 years in the top 10. But we took a significant bite out of Maude's ratings, so much so that CBS decided to move the show from Tuesday to Monday nights. None of us fully grasped how popular Happy Days was until the summer of 74, when, ahead of our second season, ABC sent Henry, Donnie, Anson, and me on a promotional tour. To maximize the show's exposure, they deployed us in teams of two. Henry and Donnie were one team, and Anson and I were the other. A lot of it was cheesy and depressing. Appearances in department stores, signing crappy, insta-published Happy Days YA novels that separated impressionable kids from their cash. Kids is the operative word. Live, we were drawing a primarily teenage audience, throngs of rabid girls of high school age and younger. I wasn't prepared for this. It seemed like a throwback to the era when I struggled to write out my autograph at the Roosevelt Hotel. In Detroit, ABC partnered us with 17 Magazine, making us pose for pictures with teen models, which was uncomfortable for Anson because he was 24, and for me because I had Cheryl. I confided in Anson that I hated this PR tour. It was tiring, it kept me from home, and as my inner Rance Howard was telling me, it had nothing to do with acting or directing. But our experience was nothing compared to what Henry and Donnie were going through. We were getting field reports that wherever Henry went, huge crowds were gathering. Fonzie, we were learning, had captivated viewers much more than any other Happy Days character. The Neiman Marcus flagship store in Dallas was completely overwhelmed by a turnout of over 20,000 people, most of them screaming girls, most of them screaming, Fonzie! The security team there was unprepared, and Henry and Donnie were trapped at one point, separated from their limousine by an unregulated mass of humanity. Crisis was averted only when Henry put on his Fonzie voice to address the crowd. I want to tell you something now, he said. You're going to part like the Red Sea. He snapped his fingers, the same way he did on the show, to summon chicks. The crowd obediently opened up a pathway to the car. When all four of us met up in Philadelphia, Anson and I got a sense of how intense Fonzie mania had already become. Our appearance at Wanamaker's department store was like Beatlemania. Girls screaming at us, throwing themselves at our limo, tearing our clothes. I chased down a girl who grabbed my ball cap. Sorry, no Richie Cunningham souvenirs. Even when I still had a full head of hair, I loved my caps, and by God, I was not going to let anyone steal them from me. I had made my share of public appearances for the Andy Griffith Show, but they were always agreeable and low-key, not unlike the show itself. This was something else entirely. And pretty terrifying. But on some level, it was fascinating being at the eye of a teeny bop storm. It was apparent that Happy Days was becoming something bigger than us, a cultural phenomenon. It was not about any single one of us. Well, maybe one of us more than the others. We finished up our stay in Philly by appearing on The Mike Douglas Show, a nationally syndicated daytime talk show. After a pleasant interview, Mike opened up the floor to questions from the audience. The first was from a young woman. My question is for Henry, who I think is super, she said. Do you believe in sex before marriage?